So welcome to Jill Abrams' Stablemates with Paul Henry, Jonathan Edwards and Kim Moore today. And as always, I'd like to thank the Arts Council England for supporting this festival and also this event. So, Jill Abrams, I'd actually say she doesn't need any introductions because we all know her. But let me do it anyway. Jill Abrams is the director of the poetry collective Malaika's Poetry Kitchen. She started this reading series, Stablemates, 2 years ago, and it features three poets from one press. Today it's Sarin Press. But Jill is also a poet herself, and her work has appeared in various places, including the Rialto, Magma, and Under the Radar. And she also featured in the Ledbury Poetry Slam once. I can still remember that. So she's also performing her poetry in lots of places. For example, she was runner-up in last year's Stanza Slam. So for today, we don't get to hear her perform, but she'll delight us with her wonderful way of chairing events. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Jill to introduce and interview our lovely guests today. So welcome, Jill.
Thank you, Katerina. I think, is it your fourth year?
Third
year at Ledbury. And Katerina and the other interns, and I'm sure you know this, Poetry Festival runs mainly on love and goodwill. So having enjoyed being here about 8 times, I'd really like you to think about all the people who work here, paid and unpaid, and put in a lot of time and effort. So let's just have a round of applause for all of them. Thank you. So I came up with the bright idea for Stablemates 2 years ago, and it came from chatting up the events manager at Waterstones Piccadilly, and so it had to be, I had to put on published poets, and I just had the idea to put three from one press that could fit in an hour, which was the time slot they gave me. And I organised the first three kind of in a row before I did them, and one of those first three was Sarin, and Sarin is the first press that I'm going around with again, and so thank you to Chloe for enabling that here at Ledbury. So the format is each poet gets a turn, and in that turn I'll have a brief chat with them, and then you'll hear some of their poems. So first of all, I'd like to invite Kim Moore to come and join me. So all the books are on sale from the Three Counties Bookshop at the back, and this is Kim's, The Art of Falling, which most recently won the Geoffrey Faber Prize, so very excited about that. And we're here at one of the oldest and longest running, in terms of duration of the festival, but Kim, you've set up your own festival. It's about to have its third go around up in Kendal. Tell us a little something about that.
Yeah, it's a lot smaller than Ledbury. We only have 12 poets a year, and it's in Kendal, set it up with my friend, a lot of how I run it, I kind of steal bits from all the festivals that I love, that I go, you know, Ledbury and Oldborough and Stanza, so.
Who have you got for this year? Who might people look forward to if they're thinking of coming?
I think the reading I'm really looking forward to is Pascal Petit, who you've had here, and Nikolai Madzorov from Macedonia. And we've got Liz Berry and David Harsent, which will be good.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I went last year, and it's a really lovely, small, contained little festival. Yeah. But it's wonderful. So if you, it's September?
Yes, I'm really bad at advertising, aren't I? September the 6th to the 9th.
Can highly recommend it. So let's talk about your own writing. Now, I'm very excited for your next collection. I know that when you started writing All the Men I Never Married, that was before your PhD, and you've now encompassed it into your PhD. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I wrote the first, probably only the first couple of poems, actually, before I started the PhD. So, All the Men I Never Married, it started as a bit of fun. I just thought I would write a poem about an ex-boyfriend that had annoyed me, and then I thought I could write one about all of the ex-boyfriends that have annoyed me, and then I thought any poem with a man in could be in All the Men I Never Married. So I'm on about number 35 now.
And will there be other poems in the new collection that aren't men you've never married?
Yeah, the kind of theme that ties the men together are two things, really. So I'm looking at how to write about sexism and then how writing about female desire and how those two things often kind of intersect or kind of encourage each other. So there will be there's a few poems that aren't All the Men I Never Married at the minute. I don't know, I haven't finished it.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm looking forward, as I'm sure everyone else is, to hear you read some poems. So please go for that. And I think you're going to read a mixture of old and new ones.
Yep. So I didn't mean to do a gasp of relief, like, oh, because I was nervous about the interview more than the reading. So, thanks for being kind. So I thought I would start with some poems from the book and then finish with some new ones. So, My people. I come from people who swear without realising they're swearing. I come from scaffolders and plasterers and shoemakers and carers, the type of carers paid pence per minute to visit an old lady's house. Some of my people have been inside a prison. Sometimes I tilt towards them and see myself reflected back. If they were from Yorkshire, which they're not, but if they were, they would have been the ones on the pickets shouting scab and throwing bricks at policemen. I come from a line of women who get married twice. I come from a line of women who bring up children and men who go to work. If I knew who my people were in the time before women were allowed to work, they were probably the women who were working anyway. If I knew who my people were before women got the vote, they would not have cared about the vote. There are many arguments among my people. Nobody likes everybody. In the time of slavery, my people would have had them if they were the type of people who could afford them, which they probably weren't. In the time of casual racism, some of my people would and will join in. Some of my people know everybody who lives on their street. They are the type of people who will argue with the teacher if their child has detention. The women of my people are wolves, and we talk to the moon in our sleep. I normally don't read that poem any further south than Manchester. Because my family are all from Leicester, although I masquerade as a northern poet. I've given up saying I'm not actually northern. So I'm going to read, because it's so hot in here, and I'm like in admiration that you've all come out and sitting in the heat. But it reminds me of, I went through this, I had a friend come to visit me in Barrow, and she dragged me around to spiritualist churches, and it was an atmosphere a bit like this, very hot and sweaty in the spiritualist church. In true poetic style, I went once and I thought, oh, all these things happened, and I thought, I'll write a poem about it. But then I was only half through the poem, so I went back. But in the poem, it comes across like it's one visit, poetic license. And I stupidly forgot to change the name of the church before the book was published. So I still live in fear that someone in Barrow will find out. So this is Hartley Street Spiritualist Church. The first hymn is Abba, I Believe in Angels. No music because Jean has forgotten the tape. We sing without, led from the front by a medium with long red hair who announces that a dog is in the room and is, at this very moment, sitting next to the tea urn. This means someone is ready to be healed. Another medium stands, running coloured ribbons through her hands, points behind and says a woman is pacing up and down, flicking her hair and pouting, and will anyone claim her? Does anyone have a relative who would do such a thing? And then the psychic artist stands up, unrolls a scroll, a picture he drew many years ago, in anticipation of this day. A man in a flat cap with a cigarette. A man who used to get back from work and watch the sun go down from his back porch and smoke and smoke. And he says, "This is your granddad, isn't it?" to a woman who nods vigorously, and then he starts to draw an old lady with short hair who he says is standing next to me. And am I feeling warm? Because this is the energy of spirit. And do I ever feel I'm being followed even though there's no one there? Because this is the energy of spirit. And come to think of it, I think I am warm, but that might be because everybody's staring and he's whispering over and over, "It's your grandma, isn't it?" And I believe him. I want to think she's there, even though in his drawing she has permed hair and glasses. He gives me the image of this woman. Later on, I bin it. But before we go, we sing "I Believe in Angels" again. So this is the title poem of the book, and it's basically my obsession with the word falling and the different ways we kind of use it in English. The art of falling. This is for falling, which is so close to failing, or to falter or fill. As in, I faltered when I heard you were here. As in, I filtered you out of my life. As in, I've had my fill of falling, a fall from grace, a fall from God. To fall in love or to fall through the gap, snowfall, rainfall, falling stars, the house falls into disrepair, to fall in with the wrong crowd, to fall out of love, to fall like Jessica, who fell down a well and watched the bright disk of the sun and moon slowly passing. For twins who start so close together, they must fall apart for the rest of their lives or be damned. To fall down a hill like a brother, to follow like a sister, to be a field and fall fallow, to fall pregnant, for vertigo, the cousin of falling, for towers and stairs and pavements which are the agents of falling, for the white cliff top of a bed, for climbers and roofers and gymnasts, for the correct way to fall, loose-limbed and floppy, to fall apart after death, for ropes and fences and locks which carry the act of falling inside, for fall which over the ocean means autumn, which means leaves like coins of different colours dropped from the pockets of trees, which means darker evenings, which means walks with the dogs, which means walking alone and not falling apart at the sound of your name, which, God help me, sounds like falling. In the middle of the book, there's a sequence of 17 poems, which strikes me as a random number now. The sequence is called "How I Abandoned My Body to His Keeping," and it explores domestic violence. I'm just going to read the first poem from that, and then a few new ones. So this is in that year. And in that year, my body was a pillar of smoke, and even his hands could not hold me. And in that year, my mind was an empty table, and he laid his thoughts down like dishes of plenty. And in that year, my heart was the old monument, the folly, and no use could be found for it. And in that year, my tongue spoke the language of insects, and not even my father knew me. And in that year I waited for the horses, but they only shifted their feet in the darkness. And in that year I imagined a vain thing. I believed that the world would come for me. And in that year I gave up on all the things I was promised and left myself to sadness. And then that year lay down like a path, and I walked it, I walked it, I walk it. So on to the men I never married. So this poem is where it kind of started. So "All the Men I Never Married," number one. There was the boy who I met on the park, who tasted of humbugs and wore a mustard yellow jumper. and the kickboxer with beautiful long brown hair that he tied with a band at the nape of his neck, and the one who had a constant ear infection, so I sat always on his left. And the guy who worked in an office and could only afford to fill up his car with £2 worth of petrol. And the trumpet player I loved from the moment I saw him, dancing to the Rolling Stones. And the guy who smoked weed and got more and more paranoid, whose fingers flickered and danced as he talked. The one whose eyes were two pieces of winter sky. And a music producer, long-legged and full of opinions, and more trumpet players, one who is too short and not him, and one who is too thin and not him. Are you judging me yet? Are you surprised? Let me tell you of the ones I never kissed, or who never kissed me. The trombonist I went drinking with, how we lay twice a week in each other's beds like two unlit candles. We were not for each other, and in this we were wise. We were only moving through the world together for a time. There was a double bassist who stood behind me and angled the body of his bass into mine and shadowed my hands on its neck, and all I could feel was heat from his skin and the lightest breath, and even this might have been imagined. I want to say to them now, though all we are to each other is ghosts, once you were all that I thought of. When I whisper your names, it isn't a curse or a spell or a blessing. I'm not mourning your passing or calling you here. This is something harder, like walking alone in the dusk and the leaves. This is the naming of trees. This is a series of flames. This is watching you all disappear. You're much better behaved than the Grange Over Sands Luncheon Club. The glamour of my poetry life. I read that poem, and when I got to the line, "Are you surprised? Are you judging me yet?" This elderly lady went, "Yes!" So I always feel like I should leave a gap, and I'm kind of dreading it. So thank you for not heckling. So that's what I mean about kind of female desire and sexism. They kind of invite each other into the room. But you resisted, so that's good. So this is jumping forward to All the Men I Never Married, number 36. And this is a kind of poem about... sexism is maybe the wrong word for it. Doing the PhD has made me realise that I use the word sexism to cover lots of different things, like... catcalling, abuse, assault, oppression, you know, it becomes this term that then becomes meaningless. But this is All the Men I Never Married, number 36. Imagine you're me, you're 15, the summer of 95, and you're following your sister onto the log flume, where you'll sit between the legs of a stranger. At the bottom of the drop, when you've screamed and been splashed by the water, when you're about to stand up, clamber out, the man behind reaches forward and with the back of his knuckle brushes a drop of water from your thigh. To be touched like that for the first time. And you are not innocent. You're 15. Something in you likes that you were chosen. It feels like power, though you are only the one who was touched, who is acted upon. To realise that someone can touch you without asking, without speaking, without knowing your name, without anybody seeing. You pretend that nothing has happened. You turn it to nothing. You learn that nothing is necessary armour you must carry with you. It was nothing. You must have imagined it. To be touched, and your parents waiting at the exit, and smiling as you come out of the dark, and the moment being hardly worth telling. What am I saying? You're 15 and he is a man. Imagine being him on that rare day of summer. The bulge of car keys makes it difficult to sit, so he gives them to a bored attendant who chucks them in a box marked property. A girl balanced in the boat with hair to her waist, and he's close enough to smell the cream lifting in waves from her skin, her legs stretched out, and why should he tell himself no, hold himself back? He reaches forward, brushes your thigh with a knuckle, then gets up to go,
rocking the boat as he leaves. You don't remember his face or his clothes, just the drop of water, perfectly formed on your thigh, before it's lifted up and away by his finger. You remember this lesson your whole life, that sliver, shiver of time, that moment in the sun. What am I saying? Nothing. Nothing happened. I'm just going to read one quick one to finish off. And thanks, Jill, for inviting me, and Ledbury, again, for being a fantastic festival. I know if you write a poem in a form, I don't think you should have to explain the form, because it should just work, shouldn't it? But I'm so proud of myself for writing in this form, I'm just going to break my own rule, because I've wanted for 10 years to write a specular or a mirror poem. I was the guest poet for a residential with Bill Herbert, and he said, oh, I read the poem without saying what it was, and he said, that's a speculum. And I said, no, it's not speculum. It's something completely different. And he was convinced. I said, no, it's a specular. And we had to Google it to prove. But I saved Bill Herbert from future embarrassment. So if you don't know what speculum is, look it up. I'm not going to go there. So this is All Night a Bird. All night a bird beats its wings behind the wall. In the space between rooms, it has the quietest scream. I realise I cannot live without desire. At first I think it's trapped behind the wall. Is it another bird that moves, that seems to fall and rise again? Yes, I am hiding something. In the morning, in the mirror, I am searching for myself, but see a bird rising up behind my eyes. I think about a girl with hair covering her face and the bruise of her body and one person listening. I think about what you said, about the need to throw a stone behind to catch the one ahead. The bird calls to me from between the walls. The bird calls to me from between the walls to throw a stone behind to catch the one ahead. I think about what you said, about the need and the bruise of her body and one person listening. I think about a girl with hair covering her face, but see a bird rising up behind my eyes. I am searching for myself in the morning, in the mirror. Yes, I am hiding something that moves, that seems to fall and rise again behind the wall. Is it another bird without desire? At first I think it's trapped, it has the quietest scream. I realise I cannot live behind the wall, in the space between rooms. All night a bird beats its wings. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kim. I don't think I've ever been so excited for so long in anticipation of a book that's still being written. But I think there's probably one person in the room who's perhaps more excited, and that's the poetry editor of Sarah and Amy Wack. Thank you for coming along. Jonathan Edwards, please come and join me. Jonathan's book, My Family and Other Superheroes, won the Costa Poetry Book in 2014, and it's a wonderful read. And it struck me as I was reading it that it perhaps seems a bit obvious to think of Undermilt Wood, and it's not because you're both Welsh, but the way you introduce the characters reminded me of Undermilt Wood. You know, oh, there's so-and-so and there's somebody else. And were you thinking along those lines at all when you wrote this book?
Oh, well, that's enormously kind. I mean, obviously a massive fan of Dylan Thomas, so that's a massive compliment. I think that sort of thing, if you grow up in Wales, you know, that sort of perception of the community is something that you kind of... You take in with the cornflakes and the milk in the morning, you know. And I think a lot of American writers were quite important to me as well. I mean, Sherwood Anderson's kind of idea of a small town community. So I think I'm interested in those sorts of communities, but I'm also kind of interested in the way that they've changed. So that those places in the valleys now are kind of increasingly suburbs of Cardiff. You know, if you go into the valleys, the way that kind of industry's changed, the way that transport links have changed. So I'm aware of those kind of personalities and those characters still being there in a kind of environment and a kind of work life which is completely different, I think. And how do those communities change and adapt and survive when the kind of reasons for those communities being there have been eroded in some way?
And as I mentioned, this came out in 2014, so I hope you've been busy since then. What are you writing now?
Yeah, I think asking a poet about their new work, I've come to the conclusion, is a bit like asking a poet about their disease. You know, I mean, like, how is your disease developing? You know, is your disease going well? You know, Paul and I were talking earlier about kind of a new work, and he said getting to the stage of the end of a new book is a bit like sliding under the door of a garage as it drops down. It's a wonderful Paul Henry poetic image, you know. I think my image would have involved vomit or something like that. I'm at that point where the garage door is coming down, and I'm worried about my bloody neck, you know. So.
Are there themes in your new work then? Is it still community, or have you moved on to something else?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's definitely there. There are more monologues, I think. There are, which comes partly out of doing lots of workshops. So you go and do lots of workshops, and monologues is a kind of great workshop activity. So that kind of, that ends up infusing your writing. But there's lots of poems about family, about community, about Wales, and about Welsh history, about famous people. The same sorts of ideas, really. And trying to explore those in a bit more depth. So the kind of things from the first book, like Campbell Kellen, is something that I'm exploring more fully, and taking on some interviews with the people who lived there and those sorts of things.
Well, I think before your head gets chopped off, we ought to hear the poems. And you've told me that you're reading all new ones, so I'm very excited about this. Please take it away.
Thanks very much. Thanks so much, Jill, and thanks so much for having me. I think Ledbury Poetry Festival made its biggest triumph today, which is getting me to escape from school early. This is fabulous. For a teacher to escape from school is like roughly equivalent to escaping from Colditz. So I'm really grateful for this. This is probably a bad thing for a teacher to say, but. Young people. I was in an airport, I think it was like an Italian school trip, basically. And out of 120 people going on the plane, there were like 119 Italian kids on a school trip plus me. This was the flight, you know. And I had this experience. I realised I've got to this age, and some of you might be getting there as well. You can look across the room at a group of young people with all of their beauty and opportunity and future and optimism, and just think in the pit of your stomach, my God, I really despise you. this is a poem about young people. It's called Jen. So here they come around the corner, bouncing, flouncing, boho beehives, tattooed, corduroy looned, sneakered scumbags, skinheads, brogue-shod uni fools. Or look, they're me, they're you, but slightly cooler. Lust and roll-up fueled, artfully spectacled idea junkies, pushing, selling. Any one of us could be John Lennon, Jesus. Coke and sneezes forced through nostrils that are pinned or pierced. Look, these feather-boa vegans or these leopard-skinned animals, with their X-rated bodies, their needs never sated by hands-free friends, or look, their palm-held search engines, their razored heads turned by beauty or a global crisis, these masters of their own devices. For every word they've hashtagged or abbreviated, each god they've never worshipped, every song they've downloaded, shook their asses to, or sung. I say, bow down, the young, the young. So, in 1956, something incredibly important happened. My dad went to the shop and bought some sweets. This was in Park Street in Crosskeys, and Park Street sounds fabulous, doesn't it? You imagine kind of people tripping through the tulips and banging their heads against hanging. Park Street is not like that. If you ever get invited, that's not the image. It's a little terrace street, and there was a shop at the end of the road, a sweet shop, which was basically someone's old lady's front room, which she converted and put jars of sweets and weighing scales there. And this was partly a business thing, but mainly to kind of increase her opportunities of being a battle axe. So this poem is about all those things. Or, as my marketing department have put it, this is a poem about someone who none of you know and which happens entirely in a place where none of you have ever been. So I hope you enjoy it. My father buying sweets. So here he is, 11, a little bugger, with his neat curls, his comprehensive training to be my lookalike. His mother's voice chases him down the terrace as he swaggers to the music of the coins in his pocket. His school tie, flipped over his shoulder, is a silk scarf sported by an artist, strutting from one absinthe joint to another in 19th century Paris. Now he looks in the window of Mrs. Bullen's sweet shop. His reflection puts his face in a jar of chocolate toffees, grinning. Chimes announce him as he steps inside, the shop, Mrs. Bullen's front room. Fearsome in pastels, she emerges, eyes him, places weights on one side of the scales, sweets on the other, offers him all she has of justice. A clatter into the till and he's out and walking home, a paper bag full in his palm. There are years in which the shop will go to bedsits, the bedsits to ruin. My father's mouth will bloom with fillings, but now his evening stretches deliciously ahead, and he pauses helpfully beneath a streetlight so we can watch him lift one gleaming thing from the bag, unwrap it, raise it to his lips, so I can taste all the butter, cream, the sugar, here on the tip of my tongue. I'm going to read, I have this kind of accidental sequence of poems about famous people visiting Newport. The most important thing about famous people visiting Newport is pace. They tend to move through at high speed and they don't come back. This is about Harry Houdini, the famous escapologist. And he came to Newport in 1905, and they threw him off Newport Bridge into the water, and he dutifully re-emerged. And my grandfather in 1905 was 15. It's a grandfather I never met because he was dead before I was born. But at 15, he was an apprentice in a Valley's Butchers. So this poem imagines that he was there watching Harry Houdini jump in 1905. Harry Houdini on Newport Bridge. He stands 100 feet above a river that's popular with suicides and lovers. He stands there in the limelight and the weather, in padlocks, chains, a straitjacket, and his immaculate moustache. The whole town, gathered, watching, breathes in. He stands 100 feet above the river and leaps. Meanwhile, in the crowd, my grandfather is busy being 15. He's presently engaged in tying the shoelaces of a policeman to those of a vicar, lifting handkerchiefs from pockets to swap them with each other. Harry Houdini has been what? A minute underwater, and in the crowd, hands are being raised to mouths. A day off for my grandfather from the family village butchers. He looks up at the chains on the watches of his father, his grandfather. A minute and a half, a woman on the bank points towards a darkness in the river, slowly turning to a bobbing head, moustache, a waving hand, a cheer. The woman starts to cry. Her husband reaches for his handkerchief. A policeman pulls a vicar from his feet. this is another one from the same sequence. I suppose this is something of an escape artist too. I suppose it's about Kurt Cobain, the lead singer of Nirvana, who came to Newport supposedly in 1991. This is the legend. To a place called TJ's. It's a little spit and sawdust nightclub where I spent most of my teenage years, and supposedly proposed to Courtney Love in this place. And when this happened, I was 12. It's 1991, I was 12. So I didn't really know who Kurt Cobain was, but a couple of years later, I was like completely obsessed. So it's about kind of just missing your heroes in this way. Kurt Cobain proposes to Courtney Love. Some young dude staggering from the station, all jeans and grimace, all tufty coat and peep-toe sneakers. That's nothing new around these parts. He rubs his eyes, approaches this first stranger. Excuse me, do you know the way to a place called TJ's? That voice he has. A mile away, Courtney Love is sound checking, warming up. Rain comes down as he passes the ruined castle, crosses the bridge. Statistics say more than 30 people will jump from that year. Nevermind has been Billboard number one for 6 weeks now. What exactly does a human being do with that much love? I am 4 miles away and 12 years old, and Kurt Cobain is walking through Newport, 3 years too early for me. At the door of TJ's, his nose ring, the biggest fan in the world, just tells him the price, stamps his hand. Inside, his eyes accustom, and he spots her at the bar, back to the room, her mane, her little girl's dress. People are brought into being by moments like this. Kurt Cobain is crossing the room in TJ's, Newport, is falling to his knees, the cold thaw through ripped jeans. The barman leaps across the counter to deal with some punter, and the bouncer, grinning, gets in the way as one girl punches another. Of course, there are those who say all this is folklore, legend, gossiped up by someone with a romantic imagination or a marketing background. I am 12 years old and dreaming in a room lined with posters of footballers, and on Newport Bridge, a couple are walking hand in hand, the man pausing now, perhaps, to light a cigarette. In that sudden spark, someone passing might almost glimpse his face before he turns away, before he walks again into the dark. I have this thing, some of you might know this, that if I'm stuck or I've got nothing to write a poem about, this is like every day basically, then I go to the zoo and see what animals are up to. Mostly my experiences in the zoo are that animals are not up to very much. I don't know if they receive some kind of warning that I'm coming there to write a poem about them, but like the day that I get there, they just they go to sleep. So this is one of those poems. It's about lions. It's the lions in Bristol Zoo. And I went there and I looked at the lion's notebook, pen, bloody lions did nothing, just lay down. And I was driving home and I had the Beatles album Revolver on in the car, and the John Lennon song, I'm Only Sleeping. So the lions started talking, and the poem, this is an interesting experience when you're driving across the Severn Bridge. The poem came out this way. So it's what the lions have got to say. Lions asleep. So look, don't bother us. We're only sleeping. Our arms around each other and our eyes tight closed. We drift, we doze. Here on the hearthside rugs our manes are, holding the hot water bottles of each other. We are dreaming. Do not disturb. Don't make us toss or turn. We're having 40 winks. Our bodies coiled or curled around each other, so it's never clear where I end, where he begins. This glass is thin. Don't bang, don't knock. We're in the land of Nod, so turn that flashlight off and tell your young, face painted for the day with our markings, roaring to be us, not to butt this window with their heads now, please. Asleep in bed is where we are. We know the zoom up makes us cover stars, but jog on, please. Go see the seals, we'll show it all for sprats like strip club dollars thrown in their direction. Leave us here, beneath the covers of each other. As a treat, if you are very good, we'll make your day a little later. Get up, pace about a bit, or raise our heads, offer our pink yawns. But don't be fooled. Beneath these snores, we think our thoughts, and death sleeps in these pores. And I'll just finish with one last one. Is that okay?
Yeah,
I'm completely lost where I am with time. So, so I'll just finish with this. This is another monologue. It's it's written from the point of view of Newport, so it's what Newport has to say for itself. And it starts early in the morning, and it goes through until late at night. Paul and I were both involved in this project, which was writing poems after Vernon Watkins in the kind of commemorations, the anniversary of his death, and it's a poem which came out of that. And Vernon Watkins got this amazing poem about Swansea, Ode to Swansea, in which he kind of celebrates Swansea. And I took that idea and wrote about Newport. So as I put it at the time, Vernon Watkins writes about Swansea, I write about Newport, or he writes about one of the most cosmopolitan, cultural, culinary, beautiful cities in Britain, and I write about another place, which is also a city. thanks, Jill, and thanks to Ledbury for having me. Newport talking. Me, I get up early, see. I like to watch the sunrise over the transporter, to sneak, perhaps, one cheeky fag to gently blow the smoke away. As the fog clears, the sun shines down on all these people. Really bloody busy is what the next hour is. Changing all the traffic lights to go, helping school kids safely cross the road. And as for him who sits in his high ride and winds the window down, and offers some imaginative or foul-mouthed advice to her in the next lane, well, he can wait and wait. 2 hours of that, I like to stop for lunch in the high fields which no one thinks I have, take in the view, the air, and share my butties with the horses, all those gorgeous stinking bastards there, whose only speed is slowness, their tails Sunday fishing line dropped in the day, whose chewing is hypnosis. An hour of them is everything I need to set me up for my big afternoon around the shops. My lovely sticky-up paving stones put paid to this shoplifter. A nudge, a wink, and this rain cloud is shifted from here above the head of this old lady who's forgotten her umbrella. Rush hour is a pain in my chest. The noise, the stress, the traffic flow, the fuel emissions up my nose. It's Friday night, and soon my streets are dance floors for these brill-creamed madmen, these blow-dry princesses, in all their giggling height of fashion. How I love to see them. How I tip the wink to skull-haired doormen, line up taxis, fling the doors of chippies wide, wide open. How I make the most of every single moment, for I know full well how this will end. It's 4 a.m., and hours since I should have been in bed. But who will watch if I don't? Here, outside Debenhams, flat on his back, this bloke with his big arms wrapped tight around the air. I've seen him crossing, recrossing my bridges, staring too long down from there to where the bubbling reflection of the stars is. Now I hover close to check his breath. He shuffles in his sleep, here in this doorway, here in this place, exactly where my heart is.
Thank you, Jonathan. And I'm very pleased to have given you an excuse to get out of work early on a Sunday. Sunny, a Friday afternoon, and there's another book to be to get excited about. Please welcome Paul Henry up to the stage.
Thanks.
Now, Paul, I'm not going to ask you how your disease is progressing. We're going to talk about The Glass Isle. And unusually for me, I'm going to talk to you about the poems that you're not going to read for us this afternoon. Because this evening at Helen's, Paul has an event called The Glass Isle with Brian Briggs, his musical collaborator. So did the poems... It's the central section of the book that gives the book its title, The Glass Isle. And did that sequence come first? Did that come before the performance version?
Most of it did, yeah. I think, I'd sort of working on a longish for me. I don't generally write long poems, but it's sort of longish poem about set on this canal bank. And then I just started collaborating on songs out of the poem as the poem was nearing its end. And what was interesting then was that I was hacking up song lyrics out of a poem that wasn't finished. And then the song lyrics, once they had music, would influence the odd phrase of the poem, the odd line, the odd meter.
So tonight, what will people hear if they come along?
They'll poetry and songs, basically. So they'll hear, they'll hear poems talking to song lyrics and song lyrics talking to poems, I think.
And the songs are separate from what's in the book?
There will be... they are... I mean, they are versions of parts of the long poem. And also a couple of other poems. So we've written other stuff around other poems. Yeah. But I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. And how does that sequence fit into the rest of the book?
It's basically bang in the middle and resonant of the usual, my usual cheerful themes of loss and temporal loss and a lot of family. There's a kind of a sub-narrative, I suppose, but I mean, it's not a narrative poem. It's a kind of a long lyric poem that somehow hangs together, but there is a kind of a another narrative, this bloke walking the canal bank.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I've heard one of the songs that was played on the Radio 2 folk show, so I can highly recommend that. I've read the book, so I can highly recommend that. So let's hear the poems that are not from the central section.
Sure, thanks. Thanks, and... It's been great to read with Kim for the first time and with Jonathan again. This first poem, there was a commission last year, and I think, Jonathan, you were commissioned with one of the poems, Seven Airs, and it was Seven Stages of Life, and it was partly the festival and partly Feral Productions who commissioned these seven stages of life, and they gave each poem a stage and a place, and they gave me the seventh stage, which could have sort of pissed me off a bit, but it didn't. I thought, yeah, that fits. My place was St. Michael's and All Saints, just up Church Lane from here. And the poem I suppose what I ended up with was a sort of a... the idea of this seventh age or stage being a visionary stage which houses all seasons and all ages. So you have this kind of, in the poem, all the people lying in the churchyard, under which I discovered a stream runs, an ancient stream runs, rising a la, Stanley Spence's Resurrection, Cookham, that sort of thing. But kind of just following their rivers back out to the sea, St. Michael's. The rivers of our childhoods find us here. Through cages in the earth they pour, and we rise, venture out in all our ages, gingerly at first, following our seasons home along their bright aisles. It is winter and the orchards are bare. A black cap outsings a name on stone. the lullaby inside a hymn, the clock and the bells. After the ice has held the river's breath, a different creature swims on over the worn cobbles, making for the sea. Another leaden, lug, door, mono, why, song without end. It is spring, and plastic bonnets in the wind give perms a holy glow under the yew, beside the stone keyholes we can't peer through. Dry inside the spaces between the rain, its cider chimes, we drift down Church Lane, carrying our apples, wizards, gas masks, our picnic blankets, tartan flasks, our hoops and cricket bats. It is summer, and the rivers have no names. In the parish of a bird's song, without coats, we follow our seasons home along their bright aisles. And I'm going to read a second poem that was commissioned, and it was for a book called Shore to Shore, which celebrated, an anthology which celebrated British bookshops and books. And my shrine was... When I used to live in Newport, was to get out of Newport on a Saturday, get up to Abergavenny, and there was a bookshop called Lockyer's. Lockyer's. The door's cowbell, tall Cyril ushering, his own bookmark between roses and Churchill, the Fay assistant's Bakelite. The floorboards creaked in poetry, a branch scratched the skylight. I could hear my sons in the park, sometimes recognized a cry, a soul's baroque latticework annotating the wasteland. The books we almost bought were precious in our hands. Keyes's The Iron Laurel, a pocket Tennyson inscribed for Olive before I sail. Weekends turned, chimed, the boys grew tall enough to panic a cowbell. Drag me home, as Mr. Lockyer's century closed on a park's empty shelves, a room full of leaves. This is about shaving in another man's mirror. Blunt razor. Your shaving mirror cuts a steel concertina affair that reaches in and out of the wall like a clown's boxing glove, the legacy of a practical man. I gaze into its misted sphere and see you there, rough-shaven, head in hands, plotting my end. I think I know your room, its haunted bed, the filigree of ice on the pane, the wallpaper's grouse motif, repeating its din in the gloom. I think I know your wounds, the edge of an old blade through winter fields. And since I've kind of gone back to writing songs more, I found myself going to festivals and feeling old. And this is about a festival field after the festival's ended and the field has been handed back to itself. So it's in the voice of the field. And festival field. The deafened owl will soon return and birdsong to its stages in air. Did I dream you were here? Your footprints filled with rain, your tightly packed rucksack, the daisy crown in your hair, wait and levitate an hour, dazed in sunlight. If you came back to hold court on these hay bales, a summer's ruins, to tell me who you were, are, and shall be under the sky's torn sails, I might sleep more easily, let centuries plow over me. And And then this next poem is about all the objects and furniture that we're left with when the last parent or guardian has passed away, and how they often have the last say on a marriage. Chattels. The trolley with a twang in its drawer, the chattels of love, the chattels of war. The tawny dining table's wings, clipped as if cutlery never sang, to the dresser with a spinning chip that kept mysterious its door. The chattels of love, the chattels of war. The metronome's pyramid on the dusty piano lid. The key without furniture on the floor. The chattels of love, the chattels of war. The standard lamp's missing claw. The gramophone that winds up Paul Robeson singing Waterboy, the convict song, once more. The chattels of love, the chattels of war. From a matchbox, this lock of hair the sunlight suddenly saw, and at the end of five rainbows, five medals nobody wore. The chattels of love, the chattels of war. Studio flat. Socks hang like bats from a skylight. They may be dry in time for the moon. The campsite owner's water feature drains more blood from the sun. Cars queue for the narrow bridge. Birds catch their pulses and fly. I am suddenly old. What's an attic but a bungalow in the sky? And where are you, my sons? I heard your voices in the bells of snowdrops pulled by the wind. These tulips have lost their smell. Perhaps I could tell you one day where the snowdrops went, why old men dry their socks on the moon, and what darkened the skylight just then. I was going to read two more poems. The penultimate one was an umbrella poem that I brought just in case, even though we're in a heat wave. But I think I'll just finish on another poem about sons, which is set in Newport, in a big park sort of area. Under the motorway, just as you're driving towards Wales, before you hit those tunnels, the Bryngelas tunnels, as you're driving west, there is a huge kind of spread of football pitches, and that's where the poem's set. It's called the Glebelands. And I'll finish on this with thanks to Jill and to Ledbury. Late kickoff. My boys are coming back to me across the Glebelands pitches, out of the echoey underpass, leaving their childhoods behind on the other side of the motorway, letting our ghosts play on into the dark, the four of us hoofing the moon high, our heads tilted and staggering like drunks to catch it, waiting for it to fall, the brightest ball in the sky, lighting our way home. They are coming back to me, taller than I imagined, and too old to warm inside my fleece. It has been too long. They must be cold by now. I'll warm up the engine. I remember when the plastic goals they used to pack at full time into sacks and bear shoulder high like fathers or dead kings back to the clubhouse were exchanged for serious steel. After that, they needed me less and less. But look, they are coming back to me, though it was I who went away. Thank you.